accepted it within a week.
Which book is this then?
This is the first book.
First book. Okay, right.
Now, this is 1961. You find all of this in Who's Who. You see the dates.
Yes.
You see.
All right.
That's right. That's how I got my first book published. Now, when I signed the contract for that, 1961,
mm-hmm.
they made me agree that I would give them my next book.
Sure.
You see? So in a couple of years, I said to Peter Ritner, I want the next book to be The World Since 1914. And he said, okay, let's sign a contract.
He's saying, like, that's a rather large subject, though.
Peter Ritner thinks I am the greatest writer around.
Okay, is he an editor?
He's a scholar. That's him.
Okay.
You see, now here's what happens, and I don't know whether we want to get this on tape, but I'll put it on tape. But look, you've got to be discreet.
Sure. Sure.
You know, you have to protect my future.
Sure.
As well as your own.
Sure.
All right. When Tragedy and Hope was signed, the contract, and right up to the last minute, which would be the spring and summer of 66, they were planning to bring it out in two volumes, boxed, for $17.50.
Mm-hmm.
Macmillan had been bought from Harold Macmillan at the Macmillan Company of England
mm-hmm.
for $5 million, because he needed the cash. In the summer of 66, a holding company, Collier Books, which originally was Morgan, and they published Collier's Magazine. Remember Collier's Weekly and stuff? All right. Collier's Books, now I don't know who controls it now, and it's one of these holding companies,
mm-hmm.
came in, they bought up the Free Press, you know, in Illinois. They bought up Brentano Bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
They bought up Macmillan. They came in, and they looked at what they bought, and they said, you're spending money wildly, you're not taking in money. We got to stop it.
The accountants for those.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they said, no advertising on any books that are published for the next 6 months. You spent too much on advertising. And the editors like Peter Ritner screamed and said, we're not going to stay if this is the way you're going to do things. So they said, all right, one ad for each book. All right, I got one ad for Tragedy and Hope. And it was a quarter page in the New York Times book review, I believe. That's
how do you spell Ritner's name?
R-I-T-N-E-R. Peter Ritner. I'm editing Who's Who. He should be. Anyway, he has since left them. I don't know what he is doing. He still lives in the same place that I visited him in Riverside Drive up near the George Washington Bridge.
Mm.
But he works for some world book thing or something.
There's a world publisher.
Something else. And what he does, I don't know, because he's never got in touch with me since he left.
And they also did not come out with the two lines.
No. And then when they saw it, they said, oh, this is going to cost too much. Cut it to one volume and cut the price $5. So that made it $12.50, but they never sold it at $12.50, they made it $12.95, so this is what it was sold. Now, it went out of print, that was 66. It went out of print in 68. But in 68, Collier Books got in touch with me, I don't know how or why, and said, we'll bring out the last half of this as a paperback, and that's what I gave you. That came out in 68. And that, I think, is still in print, but I can't get an answer, I can't get a straight answer to any questions from them. For example, they never told me until 1974, when I was trying to fight the pirate who reprinted Tragedy and Hope, that it had been out of print. They told me it's out of stock, and we will republish when we get 2,000.
Right.
But they never could get 2,000, I've told you this, haven't I? Because they were telling everybody who wrote in that it's out of print.
Now, when did you realize it was a pirate edition? How did you find out?
I found out when somebody got a plain envelope with a slip of paper in it, available again, in short supply, Tragedy and Hope.
The whole book.
The whole book. And
they came to you and said,
and no, they called me up and said, did you know that your book is reprinted? I said, which book? Because they both had a printer. And they said, Tragedy and Hope. I said, no, it isn't.
You don't know who this thing was?
No, because it's exact copy, exact. The dust jacket, everything, the binding is the same.
Did they reset the type, or is it photo
reproduction? It's exactly the same.
Right.
Now, I can tell instantly that it's different, because they didn't notice that the original had a gold, had yellow top on the pages. Here.
All right.
You see, it's original.
Right.
The new one is white.
So you, I would imagine, would call Macmillan and say, hey, you must be upset that they're reprinting. I mean, that would be a logical thing.
They didn't give a damn, and I'll tell you why.
But did you talk, now, how much is, well, we'll talk when we're done with it, and I'll ask you how much of this you're comfortable with in light of your lawsuit, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, I don't know. And I don't know why McMillan acted like this. Now, immediately...
So biologically, I should be to call McMillan and say, gee, you must really get help.
I didn't. Not right away, I didn't, because they had lied to me so many times and so many
years. Already knew. And
there's something funny. They had lied to me, you see, on everything. And I have letters to prove that, because I have from Rittner letters apologizing for information previously given to him, because they had lied to him when he called up to ask if they're out of print or not, you see, and they said no, and so forth. Now, the big thing is, my contract both had in it that if it went out of print, I had the right to recover the plates.
Right.
They never got in touch with me for the plates. I learned in March of this year that they destroyed the plates of Tragedy and Hope. I learned in the summer, 1971, because my wife got mad and called McMillan on the phone every week while I was in England, and finally got from them a letter in which they said the plates had been destroyed. They said inadvertently destroyed the plates of the first book, Evolution of Civilizations, you see?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you find, so a guy calls you an anonymous caller.
He identified himself to me, but his name, and he gave me his name and so forth, and he had got this, and, you want to shut that on? Okay. A second. And the way I found out was, I sent an order. I left somebody else sent an order. Now, this was my assistant who sent a check, sent an order, and nothing came. And then we discovered they'd only pay if you sent them cash ahead of time. You see,
that didn't do?
Well, I guess I did send a check, but
not the whole thing.
No, I sent the check, the whole thing. But they, for example, will not send to bookstores unless they send cash, and they're all suspicious. Because if you order 10 copies, and that would be $120, because he was asking 12, you could vanish, because there's no way to find out who it is.
Sure.
You have no name. You have a box number in California and so forth. And anyway, I couldn't find out anything. I got it back, and I was shocked because it was identical. You see, it was almost identical. So then I got other companies were offering it.
When is this?
This was in this year.
This year?
Yes, January.
January
74.
Okay.
This year. By March, somebody came to me and had one of the pilot companies. Where'd you get it? And they said, Sidney Kramer. I said, does he have it? And he said, sure, he has 4 or 5 in there. So I called up Sidney Kramer and asked if he had it, and he said, yes. And I went down there, and it's very hard to get information. But finally, I found out that he sent an order in, and they sent me a check, and I'll send it. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And he sold them and repeated the order, and so forth. So then I told our bookstore.
He's using the same address you have?
Yes.
You still don't know who it is. And at that time, you did not know who it is.
I still am not certain.
Really?
Who it is. And I will now, and I'll tell you why. One of the places that was offering it for sale, and there was about 5 places that were offering it for sale, and I've got since a number of others, is that they come to me from students or they don't come back to me directly ever. Now, no one ever approached me. Well, one reason I was suspicious of McMillan was this. The fact that the radical right, the John Birch Society and so forth, was getting all up over this book goes back to at least 69.
I was going to ask you about that.
69. Yes, and a book appeared called The Naked Capitalist by Skousen. Now, of that book, about a fifth of it is direct quotes from my book. Now, he says it's from my book, it's in quotation marks, but nevertheless, it's a violation of copyright. I got in touch with McMillan. They would not do a thing. They said, I said, aren't you going to defend my copyright? They said, no, if you want to do something, we will support you and, you know, and be a witness if you want and so forth. Well, I wasn't going to sue this guy. He's a professor of religion at Brigham Young University, former police chief of Salt Lake City, you know, about
him.
All right.
He's run the gamut.
So whether he has, and he's been in the FBI for years.
Right.
So whether he would have any money, it wouldn't be worth my while to sue him, you see, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And another state and so forth. So I decided I'd let that go, but then I discovered they wouldn't do anything. And then Congressman Rarick, who was beaten in the primary just now, put that book into the congressional record, and a lot of things like this. Then this book was distributed to every registered voter in New Hampshire.
At no point, they never called you and said, and after a quote, I mean...
No, nobody ever...
It'd be like you telling the story without ever talking to you.
Yeah. Nobody ever wrote to
me
about
this. Hmm? Do you know where they got the picture of you from the PR office?
I think, let me see which picture it is. They tried to get pictures from the PR office, and I said, don't give anybody a picture if they won't tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they got this from the PR office. Mm-hmm. Now, Scoosens couldn't get a picture of me. Mm-hmm. You see, they could have got a picture off the back of the full picture of me, on the back of the jacket of the first book,
mm-hmm.
from Backrack,
mm-hmm.
here in town. But, you know, that's the one they have in the public relations office here now, still. It's the only one there is, and that's where they got that. Well, it's all right, but then they put on the same page with J.P. Morgan, you know, this is a nonsense to me.
Yeah,
I mean, you're right to laugh. It's a joke, but it's also silly, linking me with Morgan or with any of these people. But then they're full of statements. Anyway, Rarick and other people have filled the congressional records with this. Then the John Birch Society started talking about it in their various publications. And then, of course, this guy is a John Birch employee.
Yeah.
And he published, even before this, did he? The book, Nixon, The Man Behind the Mask. Yeah, that's in 69. Oh, I knew nothing about that until 2 weeks ago.
Really?
Nixon, The Man Behind the Mask. One of the priests here met me and said, I've been looking for you. I said, well, look, it's free. Go right and look all you want. He said, no, I want to ask you about this Gary Allen who wrote a book about Nixon. And I said, well, I know Gary Allen. I didn't know he wrote a book about Nixon because I don't keep up with this stuff. And he said, well, I have it. And the whole third chapter is about you and your book, Trans Help. I said, really? So he let me have it, and I read it, and it was. And now there's others. That
you don't know Gary Allen personally.
No. Now, here's what happened. A crisis occurred at Brigham Young, and I should not go into it in detail because I don't know anything for sure.
Yeah, I know something.
All right. The campus was blown apart by a fight between the political science department and Scoosens, in which they declared he was unworthy to be a Mormon professor and should be fired,
right.
And he defended himself, and what happened, I do not know. All I know is this.
He lost.
Who?
He lost.
Oh, did he?
He got ousted.
Oh, I didn't know that. You see, I never find out. Nobody ever tells me these things.
I'll check. Why don't you please talk to that? Quite weird. The dust of the finale.
He did get rid of him, huh?
He did. I think he lost that fight when the University of Austin. I know where to go.
Well, anyway, the reason, all I know about it is this. I gave 3 papers at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I'm going to give you one of them.
Yeah.
And because they liked it so much, they printed thousands of them, or, you know, processed thousands and distributed them to all the press in the press room.
Yeah.
They liked this one, so it wasn't the best of them. General Crises in Civilization, you know, which this is an attractive title. Now, somebody called me up and wanted to talk to me at this. And I think it was at this. And he said his name was Larson, and he was a scientist from Brigham Young, and he wanted to see and talk to me because of what was going on up there. I said, well, what is going on up there? Oh, he says they have mass meetings on this, and he says it's just an uproar all the time. And I didn't know. Now, he made an interview with me, and he wanted to play it on the campus radio or the local radio station, and I said, all right.
What was the interview about?
About
the
controversy.
Okay.
And I said, all right, let me know what happens. But he never wrote to me. I never found out.
Mm.
I never made any effort, so I don't know whether it was ever broadcast or not.
What was your input in that? What did you have to say about the Scoosens controversy?
Well, I simply told him that Scoosens wrote this book. He never
talked to me
about it. He violated my copyright. It's full of lies and things that are untrue. It takes things out of context and misinterprets them. And I gave him the specific things where I disagree. The group that I'm writing about was originally, in my mind, the group established secretly by Lord Milner in 1998-99 called the Roundtable Group, which still publishes a quarterly magazine called the Roundtable in London, which is one of the world's best sources of international relations information since 1910. The first editor of it was Lord Lothian, at that time Philip Carr, K-E-R-R, and nobody knew this really for years. I got to know things, and I investigated that group, you see?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how I found it is very interesting. I noticed that prominent people in English life had Fellow of All Souls College. Lord Halifax, who was the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, and then they made him ambassador to America. When they take the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs and makes him ambassador to Washington, which most people would consider a downward step. It shows how important they considered Washington's support would be in World War II, you see. Mm-hmm. All right, he's a fellow of all souls. The fellow who summoned Neville Chamberlain on the 10th of May, 1940, and said, for God's sake, go, was Leo Amery. All right, he was a sidekick, the chief lieutenant, political lieutenant of Lord Milner. See, mm-hmm. He was a fellow of all souls. And so I decided I would study all souls. This is purely historical. I got the names of all people who had been fellows of all souls since 1899 to whenever I was doing it, which would be about 1947. And there were 149 of them. I discovered most of them were fellows for only 7 years, which is the regular appointment. It's for 7 years. But some of them were for 55 years fellows of all souls. A man named Dougal Malcolm, who was the head of the British South Africa Company, which is what Rhodesia, you see. And he was 55 years. I discovered that Lord Brand, who had been with Milner in South Africa, was for years, and he was the head of Lazar Brothers Bankers in London. And I discovered that Leo Amery was for years, and so forth. And above all, I discovered a man named Lionel Curtis, who had no right whatever to be a fellow of all souls. You get to be a fellow of all souls either because you are a very prominent person, and it's an honorary thing, you will become an honorary fellow for 7 years, or because you are an outstanding scholar and you get it by competitive examination when you graduate. That's how Lord Halifax got it. His name was Charles Wood. In 1903, when he graduated from Oxford, he took a competitive examination and got it. But he's kept it. Now, I discovered he kept it because he went immediately to South Africa and met the kindergarten, which was the group of people that were running South Africa for Lord Milner, you see. They were called kindergarten because they were all young kids. Mm-hmm. You see. Now, these are the ones who remain forever after, fellows of all sorts, or in Lionel Curtis's case, he's the man who said, we've got to change the name from British Empire to Commonwealth of Nations. And the reason is they had been students of Alfred Zimmern, who wrote a book in 1909 called The Greek Commonwealth, describing ancient Greece, you see, mm-hmm. and who was the man who made Arnold Toynbee a great classical scholar, do you see, and brought him into international affairs. Now, I knew none of this. Mm-hmm. All I knew is that here was a fellow, Lionel Curtis, who was such a poor student, it took him 15 years to get his degree, and then he got it about the lowest pass degree or something that you could ever get.
Mm-hmm. And, well,
nobody had ever heard of him.
Right. But
Furthermore, he was Lord Halifax's roommate at All Souls for years. And then I discovered this fella is behind everything that's going on. My own Curtis, you see? Now, I don't think we should talk too much about this.
Well, no,
you see? All right. But having discovered that, I met Alfred Zimmern. He came here to give a speech. And I said, isn't it funny that also he's got the roundtable group? I'd never heard of him. That's sure how little I knew it. They'd been around since 1909 and published his magazine since 1910, and this is 1947. And I said, what is the roundtable group? He named them, who they were. And he says, I was a member of them for 10 years, from 1913. And they brought me in and invited me because I was in the Workers' Education Alliance. This is extension programs, night courses, summer courses for workers, Workers' Education Alliance. And he said, that's why they brought me into it. And I was for 10 years. And he says, I resigned in 1923 because they were determined to build up Germany against France. He says, I wouldn't stand for so I resigned. Now, when I met Lord Brand later and asked him about this, he had never seen about a resignation. Now, and so I better stop talking because, you see, this gets into all kinds of things. Now, this is, I knew the Round Table Group was very influential. I knew that they were the real founders of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and I knew they were all the stuff that's in print, that they were the real founders of the Institute of Pacific Relations. I knew that they were the godfathers of the Council on Foreign Relations here. Mm. I knew that, for example, you know the big study of history, many volumes of Arnold Toynbee? Mm-hmm. All right. I knew the manuscripts of that were stored in the Council on Foreign Relations during the war so they wouldn't be destroyed by German bombing, do you see? Mm. And so forth. And so forth. So I began to put these things together and discovered that this group was working for the following things. They were a secret group. They were working to federate the English-speaking world, mm-hmm. the English-speaking world, mm-hmm. they were closely linked to international bankers. They were working to establish a world, what I call a three-power world. And that three-power world was the Atlantic bloc of England and the Commonwealth and the United States, Germany, Hitler's Germany, Soviet Russia, the three-power world. They said, Germany we can control because boxed in, and all of this is in my book, mm-hmm. it's boxed in between the Atlantic bloc and the Russians. The Russians will behave because they're boxed in between the Atlantic bloc, the American Navy and Singapore and so forth, mm-hmm. and the Germans, you see? And therefore, now this is all described in my book, and this was their idea. Now notice, it's a balance of power system. Mm-hmm. It's essentially what Kissinger, although he doesn't know what he's doing, he's bungling everything. Because he's just a prima donna, you know, emotionally unbalanced person. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing, but it was a good idea. And what he should have been doing is described by me, and you really should read this, in Current History for October 1968. Now, if I had a copy, I'd give it to you, but I don't have it. It is how to construct a multi-block world in which the United States would be secure as we ever can be, and be independent and have freedom of action, do you see? But he's blowing it in one way and another, and the whole thing's going to explode in space, I'm afraid. And I hope to God it doesn't, because we can't afford, you know, another mess like this, these incompetents. Now, what is said in here is that these people are for world domination, and if you and the group I'm talking about were not. They were largely partly financed, for instance, by Rhodes, the Rhodes Trust. And how Milner got into this was he was the chief Rhodes trustee. Mm-hmm. From 1905, he came back from Africa to his death in 1925. All right. So this was it's an Atlantic bloc. This, you know, Streit, Clarence Streit, S-T-R-E-I-T, Union Now, Union Now with Great Britain. All right. He represents what this group wanted. Clarence, S-T-R-E-I-T, if he's still alive, he probably lives in Washington. I had his daughter in my class, or as a visitor, but not as a student of mine. And he was built up by this people as the only solution. This is in my book, his name and when it happened. And
by the round table people.
By the round table people. And it was his book, Union Now, which came out in 1938, was called anonymously in the Round Table magazine by Lionel Curtis, The Only Way, it was headed. It was then reviewed anonymously in the Christian Science Monitor by Lord Lothian as the solution of our problems. And what it is essentially a union of the Atlantic bloc.
Well, we're going to wait, and we'll be playing the rest of this after the news comes on. But you understand that this was an evolution of ideas, and it started out, they were going to simply federate the English-speaking world. But these ideas would evolve as time went by, and the members of the Council on Foreign Relations would develop even further and more progressive ideas than the original English group, which really intended, of course, to take over all English-speaking nations, unite them into a one-world system. And, of course, as you notice, he talks about how they backed Hitler's Germany. Little-known facts in history. Well, we'll be back right after the news.